Local writer Fiona Garland has a new book out, and it's called Now That You're Gone. And Kieran Mooney spoke to her about her book, and then he first asked her why it was crime fiction and why was that the genre that she picked to write about.
Personally, I've always loved detective novels. And then I work as a journalist for the Irish Times, so I've seen a lot of court cases too, and I've seen various murders and various other cases I would have covered and how they pan out, and I'm fascinated by them. And then the other element of the book is related to court drama, and I always loved a good court drama. I don't know if you remember Crown Court. Used to be on at lunchtime.
Yes,
in the 1980s.
Yeah,
and I used to come home from school and watch it for, it was about 20 minutes long, and have my lunch and then rush back to school again. I always loved that. It was fascinating. So I've always enjoyed that.
And when you said you enjoyed detective novels, who would you read yourself?
Oh gosh, lots. Yeah. Colin Dexter, of course.
Okay.
Morse is a particular.
Yeah.
Favourite of mine. I love Liz Nugent at the moment. Claire McIntosh is great. Scottish writer, do you know her?
And do you think then that affects your own writing? Do you take from them?
I try not to read detective novels while I'm writing one.
Okay. Yeah,
I try to separate the two.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure whether it, I mean, you admire people's work and that kind of thing, but whether it seeps into your own or not, I don't think it does at this stage. Maybe earlier it might have.
What about then the fact that sometimes the genre is seen as not really literature, or it's placed a little bit outside in its... and we were just chatting before about Poolbeg Crimson because it has that own space for it. What do you think of that?
I don't know whether you're across that row with John McGahern making certain comments. He changes his name to Benjamin Black to write his crime. And he's terrific at it. They're really good books. But he was a little bit derisory about them, I think, at a literary festival. And then, of course, Colm Tobin made some remarks that didn't go down terribly well on Twitter about crime writing and how he doesn't read crime books. The implication was that it was below him. And I think it's laughable, and I think it's a pity. And I sometimes wonder whether... there's a lot of women writing crime now. And I just sometimes wonder whether that has something to do with the fact that crime writing is more derided now than maybe it was 30 years ago.
So technically, Agatha Christie is just chick lit.
Well, she's a master at her craft, isn't she?
Yeah. I hadn't really thought of that angle, speaking of women then, do you think it's important that in your book there's a woman protagonist, the lead character is a woman?
Well, for me, Beatrice was a voice in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how she came about, simply as a voice in my head. She wasn't a positive choice to write a woman as the lead character. But that's just how it happened. I've written in the voice of men and in short stories and things like that. So it was just an organic and not a conscious choice for me anyway.
Mm.
But I like to think that a woman's perspective has a lot to offer too, to these kinds of dramas. A little less on the macho side and a little more insightful, perhaps emotionally insightful.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not every scene is going to end up with a digging match where she's going to sort out the bad guys with that.
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
When it comes to writing a novel, then, does it take you very long? And as a journalist who's writing all the time, is this something that helps you or does it hinder you?
Well, I think the disciplinary element of being a journalist helps, because you know that you have to write, you must sit down and you must write the story. You need to sit on the chair and do what it takes to get the words onto the page. And so that helps, having that discipline behind you. Having said that, the first book I wrote took me a long time because I was writing it at a very leisurely pace. I wasn't writing it for anyone in particular, and I wasn't going to send it anywhere till it was well written and finished. Whereas the second book, I have a 3-book deal with Poolbeg Press, so the second book required me to write within a year. So that was a different experience. Again, I had to bring more discipline to it at that stage. But then that was good for me. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I could get it done and I knew where it would end up in print.
I'm kind of fascinated by the world of the writer. I mean, did you have to take months off work and get yourself a residency in somewhere exotic or particularly quiet in order that you would have time to write?
I didn't take any time off work.
Oh, okay.
I write at weekends mostly. I do a lot of evening shifts. Sometimes I write a wee bit in the morning, but I don't put myself under too much pressure to do that. It's mainly weekends that I focus on my writing. I've never believed that, you know, that maxim, oh, you should be writing every day. If you don't have time, you don't have time. But as long as you have a disciplined pattern of when you're going to write, I think that's okay. So that works for me. But also, I've never written away from home. I did try it. I did go away for a writer's retreat, but it didn't suit me to be writing away from home.
Yeah.
I have my husband built me a little shed at the end of our garden, so I'm down there, and that's where I write.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So he sends you down to the shed at the bottom of the garden.
Yeah, yes. Okay. Exactly.
and you don't spend months on end in Paris at the Irish Writers' Residence or something like that. Not
I
writing.
I wish.
When it comes to the main character, I suppose, Beatrice, but when it comes to characters in general, I mean, how much do you think then that Beatrice is based on your own life? Is she a bit like you?
I think there's a bit of me in every character in my book because I wrote it, so there has to be. I don't think there's any escaping that. And some of the things that Beatrice believes, I would believe, and some of the things she believes and says, I certainly wouldn't believe and say. She doesn't like children, for example, very much. And she's very, very wary of the world and because of past experiences, and she's afraid of trusting people. Whereas I automatically trust people until I'm proved otherwise.
So is that something that's in yourself that you're almost able to flip over and then give that to the protagonist?
I wish I could say it was that conscious.
Yeah.
But it's not that conscious at all.
Yeah.
For me, anyway.
When we were talking about writing, you were telling me that you don't really know where the story is going as you're writing it. And I was just really surprised by that. I thought that you needed a plot and you needed to have clarity on where it was going, and particularly with a detective story. So you just make it up as you go along.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. It works different ways for different writers. I know some writers who build up their character profiles, their plot outlines, they sketch out every chapter before they actually sit down and write every chapter. That doesn't work for me. I mean, I've tried it, but I just couldn't work, because when I've plotted so much and got to the end of what happens at the end, then the desire to write it leaves me. So I need to not know myself what's going to happen next. It's like every chapter, for example, might be like a room, and the next chapter is the next room, and I am opening the door into the next room at the same time as the reader is opening the door into the next room. Now, that's not to say that when I've got the first draft down, that there isn't a lot of reworking to do afterwards. Yeah. And sometimes it's because of the nature of the way I write that I do have to do maybe more reworking than a plotter would have to do.
And do you have to go back and kind of put hints into earlier parts of what's coming, because you didn't know what was coming when you were writing the earlier parts?
Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Sometimes, okay. Because so much of the act of writing is subconscious, I think. It's something is going on in the back of your head that you're not consciously aware of. So there is a part of your brain that's plotting.
Yeah.
But you're just not consciously aware of that part. And sometimes you put things in and you look back and you say, oh gosh, that's why that was in there.
So in the early part of the novel, when she's staring longingly at the kitchen knife, that then comes out later, is it?
Yeah, it can be something like that, but not always. Obviously.
Yeah, but you do want to give the reader kind of hints and tips on the way to... Yeah,
You do, but obviously you try very hard not to be too obvious.
Yeah.
I remember there was one section in this book where I had Beatrice, for a very tenuous reason, go into a particular room. And the editor, when at editing stage, said, you'll have to take that scene out. Because once she went into that room for no good reason, really, I knew that something was going to happen in that room later that wasn't good.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it was too much of a flag.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that kind of thing can happen.
Yeah, that's curious, okay. Mm. But you do get an editor then that will actually support you and has a kind of expertise or experience in the field to say that that doesn't really work.
Yes. Okay. Gay Shortland edits. For Poolbeg, and she's terrific at what she does, and of course she's coming with a cold eye to your work. Mm-hmm. And you desperately need a cold eye,
yeah,
because you can't really see it, you're so close to it.
It's obviously, well, maybe I suppose with all detective novels, but it's dark in places. Some of it is quite dark. I mean, is it something that you're fascinated with, that darker side of life? And I know, because I asked you earlier, but you haven't had any close friends who were murdered or anything. So
no, I haven't.
Not, you don't write from personal experience in that sense.
No, I don't. Yeah. But I have covered a lot of murder cases for the Irish Times. I would have covered a lot of trials, and some of them were incredibly dark. So dark, in fact, that I don't think I could ever write about them fictionally. Because I covered the Graham Dwyer trial, for example.
Okay, yeah.
And the darkness in that was just shocking.
Yeah.
And I think to write a good crime fiction novel with a character that dark would require getting inside that person's head.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not a kind of a head I'd like to be inside.
Yeah. There is a kind of a, I'm not sure what the title of these things are, but is it kind of crime porn or something, that they rewrite the story of that? Is that something that you would ever read?
The true crime.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah,
crime porn. true crime.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I had no desire after that trial to do that.
Yeah.
Though people had said to me, maybe you should think about it. But
I didn't want to think about it.
No, I actually didn't want to go there. Once that trial was over, I'd really had enough of that darkness for a long time.
Do you know I was selected for a jury duty for that trial?
Were you?
I was, yeah, yeah.
And did they reject you?
Well, I wasn't available. I knew it was going to go on for months and months.
Oh, yeah.
So I asked to be excused for that. But, even though it was a strange day, never mind months of it.
Yeah.
In terms of, I suppose, the human frailty side of it, is that something that fascinates you, that people make mistakes?
Everybody makes mistakes.
Yeah.
And mistakes can be on the larger side or the smaller side. And some mistakes you can get over and everything's fine. And in other ways, what seems like a small mistake can have a huge impact on the person's life.
Yeah, that's a bit I was looking at, yeah. That if you're just unfortunate for one day, you just made a minor enough error, but you had to pay a really heavy price for it. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's life, isn't it? Sometimes. I also find that plays out in courts. So, for example, there's a family court case that runs through the spine of this book. And it's a couple who are getting a separation. And all of their dirty linen gets washed in court. And not only that, I find it fascinating to look at the way different sides spin similar events.
Mm-hmm.
So the story they tell around something that happened between them, for example, or something that happened to the children, and how each side can try and spin it to suit themselves. And where is the truth? And I'm quite fascinated where the truth might be and all that.
Yeah, some of that, when I was reading it, I thought it was quite kind of dark or very pessimistic. And you could almost see, as an outsider standing outside, the truth is clearly somewhere in the middle here. But these people are so full of hate that they just can't do anything but believe their own, at times, incredible versions of what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, it's something I really feel strongly about, because I having covered a lot of family court cases and having covered lots and lots of divorces and separations and things, and usually it's the separation when it's most contentious.
Yeah.
I really feel strongly that the court isn't the place to sort out those problems. The court is not... People sometimes go to court because they think that a judge is going to turn around and say to them, you're right and he's wrong. But actually, that doesn't happen. Nobody gets vindication.
That's the kind of desire that someone would say, that you were vindicated and stuff. But
it doesn't work.
At a mediation,
like
they might just say, yeah. "Well, there was a problem." So
yeah.
I had read some of those passages, okay, and I thought I reflected that maybe I have a really happy magical marriage, which is maybe not something I'd say all the time.
That's funny because when they only opened up courtroom family courts in 2014 to journalists. Up to then you couldn't go in at all.
Okay.
Now you can go in and report without naming, as long as you don't identify the people involved. So when I started covering for the Irish Times, after about a week I went home to my husband and I said, I don't care what happens, you're never getting a divorce.
yeah
because
yeah.
it's so ugly.
Yeah, and that part I think does come out as a kind of background story in it, which is yeah that's nice. In terms of the main story, I suppose one of those things is the romance that runs behind the story as well.
Mm.
And it's very understated, and the kind of tension between the characters. Is that how you deliberately wanted to play the romance?
It is, because in the first book, you learn that Beatrice and Gabriel Ingram had a relationship, but it came to an end because Beatrice wasn't willing to give Gabriel Ingram the kind of commitment that he was looking for. He was looking for something solid and, you know, moving in together and all those kinds of things. And she couldn't do that.
And there's something about the way that she's a stenographer,
mm-hmm.
but it's a world that's fading. It's the kind of electronics and digital technology is taking over, so she's less needed. And he's a retired guard.
Yes.
Are they kind of out there somewhere, not really, not in the centre of society, not with the happening kind of world? And
yes, they are. They're on the edge a little bit. Beatrice in particular, and she's very controlled in her ways. You know, she's quite routine in her ways and she's quite scared of change and things.
And was it my reading, or is she very moderate as a drinker and he's much more fond of a few drinks?
He's very fond of the pint. Yeah. He's very fond of the pint. She doesn't really drink at all.
There's a clash across that for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, and she's wary of it. We don't know yet why she's wary, but
yeah. And were you tempted to write any great sensual love scenes into it?
We were talking about this earlier. It's not my forte. I for two reasons. I think if the sex matters, in terms of the detail of the sex matters, then you should write about it. But if it doesn't matter where he put his hand or whatever, there's no need to write about it. And it's, in ways, it can be more powerful simply to know that it's happened rather than to go into the details of how it happened.
Okay.
Also, I would be abysmally bad at writing a sex scene, and I think I would probably end up with the bad sex scene award or something like that. And a bad sex scene can really ruin a book.
Yeah, I suppose people can stop reading, can't they?
Yeah.
They just don't go
any further. It's just so appallingly bad. You just, you know, you put the book down.
But do you think there's any pressure to write sex into books?
Well, there can be an expectation that there might. I mean, we're in the modern era, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and it's part of the package. And then, of course, all those successes, the Shades of Grey series that sold so many. So, I mean, a lot of the time publishers are fond of a book that will follow on for, or that can be tagged as, if you liked this, you'll like that, you know.
Okay, yeah.
That sort of thing, that they are fond of that. But having said that, Poole Beg have never asked me to put sex in it or do anything.
Yeah.
You know, they work with the plot they're given.
Yeah.
They don't try and shoehorn in things that aren't there.
And there wasn't a little temptation to go with a steamy cover of a very lascivious couple or something like that to jump off the bookshelves kind of thing.
The cover is the publisher's forte. So actually, I really just get here, what do you think of this cover? And, you know, usually they're really good. I mean, I'm really happy with the cover on this book. I think it's very strong.
Yeah, it's quite eye-catching, okay. There is a sense of the darkness that's in it, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, because it's something that I'm very fond of myself, about how descriptive it is in parts, and about how much of Dublin streets that you go into.
Mm.
And again, I was saying to you that I remember hearing that when Joyce was living in Trieste or something, he wrote to his aunt in Dublin to find out how high a wall was, because if he was writing the piece about someone jumping over the wall and it was too high and it made no sense, his whole book Ulysses would have been meaningless. but do you like that detail?
I do. I do like to write about Dublin because I love Dublin. Mm-hmm. So I do like to be able to tell people, if someone's going from A to B, how they got there. And I like it to make sense, because I think that if it doesn't make sense, it can throw people out of the novel. And the whole idea is to keep them in the bubble of that novel and keep them believing the reality of that world, even if it's unrealistic to some extent. And if you get those kinds of little things wrong, you know, if I was writing a book set in the 1980s and I gave someone a smartphone, for example.
Yeah,
you know, those kinds of things are very jarring.
Yeah, some of it's very believable because getting from Stonybatter to Clontarf.
Yeah. it matters that you go the right way. And, to me, it matters.
Well, I suppose if you were reading it and you go, there's no way you'd get there in 5 minutes at 5 o'clock in the evening. She couldn't have made it back, you know. And it does throw the kind of plot and the fact that you don't accept it anymore. Yeah. Do you know places like Stonybatter and the Basin quite well? Because they're just so detailed about some of those places.
Yeah, I do. Well, in fact, I was born in Stonybatter was our first home when I was a small child. So I know the area very well. I know Phoenix Park very well.
Yeah.
And then Blessington Basin. I remember writing an article for the Northside People on Blessington Basin, and it's a lovely spot for a walk. It's just people, it's tucked away there along the canal, and
it's amazing how close it is to O'Connell Street.
And it is really close. And people just don't notice it, really. It's kind of hidden.
I cycle through it sometimes. I think there's a no cycling sign.
Oh, is that? You're mad thing.
But it's also a great scene for a crime.
Yeah, because it's so deserted most of the time.
Yeah. It looks like it deserves crimes. okay. So will you read us a piece then?
Okay.
Yeah.
I will. All right. So this is from Now That You've Gone. I'll set the scene for you a little bit. Beatrice Barrington is a stenographer in Dublin, and she has a friend called Georgina. And Georgina, her husband died a few months back, and she has some small children, and the world is falling apart for her a little bit. And Georgina gets a call late at night. At least Georgina phones Beatrice late at night, sounding quite distressed. She's taken the children down to Wexford for a bit of a break, but she has obviously had too much to drink. She's on a beach, and Beatrice is really worried about her and decides that she's going to drive to Wexford from her own home in Clontarf and help her. So she's talking to her on the phone as she's driving. So this is Georgina speaking now. It was a mess. Before he got himself dead, Beatrice, she began to sob. It wasn't right anymore. I couldn't trust him. What do you mean, Georgina? I started the engine, put the phone on speaker and turned the car toward the city. Did you ever see an apple and it's all red and shiny and you bite in and it tastes great? Did you? An apple, yes. I signalled right to head for the East Link Bridge. Go on, I'm listening. And then you take another bite and there's a little brown maggot in there. That's what it was like. There was rot hidden in it. It seemed to me that the sound of the waves behind Georgina had got closer. Where are you now, Georgina? The sea is lovely, isn't it? Have you ever seen it at night? It goes on forever. It's very cold, though. There was silence for a few moments. Georgina? They say you don't notice the cold after a while. I was on Strand Road. The traffic was light and the rain had stopped. To my left, I could see the tide was in and the waves were white-topped. Killiney Hill was spotted with lights, and beyond that, I could see the shape of Bray Head. It would take at least an hour to get to Ballymoney. I'd love a cup of tea, Georgina. What? I'm cold. I'd love a cup of tea. Do you mind if I call in? But you're in Dublin. No, I'm not far from you now. I'm on my way. Would you put the kettle on? I could hear breathing on the other end of the line. I don't want to go back inside, she said. I try to picture the little beach in my head, the curve of rocks around it, the path leading back to the road and Georgina's house. Wasn't there a bench somewhere, set back a little from the beach? Don't, so, I said. Don't go back. I'll meet you on the bench. You know, the green bench. Turn around. Can you see it there? Yes, she said. Sit up there then, will you? Out of the wind a bit. Then we can talk properly. There was no response, but I thought I could hear the crunch of sand beneath her feet. The waves quieting a little. Georgina? I'm here. Okay, good. I heard sloshing then and swallowing. What's that you have? A very nice red. Never knew it tasted good, straight from the bottle. No middleman, no middle glass, I mean. She began to laugh. It sounded to me as though her whole body was convulsing, as though she might laugh herself sick. Did you take anything else, Georgina? Any pills? No, forgot about those. She sounded regretful. If I did that, I could just be gone. Do you know how much I wish I was gone? No. If it wasn't for Millie and James and Emma, what about Emma? We had a row. I think she hates me. Of course she doesn't. She's just being a teenager. You didn't hear her. Then she said to me, what about the time he just disappeared when we were out in the pub for lunch and we had to get a taxi home? And I told her, B, that he'd had a work emergency. I told her Andrew was at work and she said, yeah, right. I heard you screaming at him that night. I hadn't thought she'd heard. I thought they were all asleep. I wasn't equipped to say the right things to calm her. Try not to dwell on it was all I could manage. Don't you see, B, if I walked into the sea right now, I'd be doing it for her. I didn't see. I didn't know what to do except keep driving. I heard her take another slug from the bottle. I don't know what you mean, I said. Of course you don't. You don't know about marriage, do you? You're innocent of it.
That's great. That's great. Thanks very much.
Okay.
That was lovely. I'd highly recommend the book.
Thank you.
I think it's a great read. And there's so much in it. It's really, we didn't even go into, and we're nearly out of time, but all those things around abuse and child abuse and pornography and migrants and all those places. And it's a very modern novel. It's very topical. It picks on all sorts of stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. So it was a great pleasure. And thanks very much for coming.
Thanks for your time.